This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There can be few places that seem as far away as the Sudan. Africa's largest country sprawls almost 1,000 miles from the southern border of Egypt all the way down to Uganda. For the past half century, a civil war between the Arab Muslim North and the Christian-dominated South has flared on and off, and now, just as agonizingly difficult peace talks are said to be close to an agreement, a new conflict has erupted in the western part of the country. For much of this hour, we'll focus on that new conflict in Darfur province, a humanitarian disaster that prompts questions about ethnic cleansing and the meaning of the word genocide. But first, Ambassador Michael Raneberger joins us. He's the State Department Special Advisor for Sudan Policy. He just returned to Washington this morning from Naivasha, Kenya, the site of the peace talks on the long-running North-South civil war in Sudan. And, Ambassador, thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with you.
Last week, State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said a peace agreement between the North and the South could be reached within days. How's it going?
Well, it's not going as quickly as we would like, but the parties, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement and the government of Sudan, are making progress. It's been painfully slow. They are now actually at the point where they've resolved almost all the issues. Two issues remain, which they are sorting out, and we're still quite hopeful that they will reach agreement within the coming few days.
And what are those two issues?
Well, the two issues, it gets quite complicated, but basically they are the percentages of exact power sharing between the government and the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in two areas of Sudan called the Nuba Mountains and the Southern Blue Nile. These are two of the so-called disputed conflict areas. And then the exact details of how a settlement for a separate area called Abyei will be worked out.
Mm-hmm. Some people have questioned whether these talks, I mean, obviously the administration has played a key role in these talks and has pressed for them, but that the SPLA and the government in Khartoum, neither are exactly models of democracy.
Well, I don't think you could say that either is democratic. That's absolutely right. What I think is motivating both sides in this process is a self-interest. Both sides have sort of fought themselves to a standstill on the ground, and last year, in fact, agreed to a cessation of hostilities. And I think both sides have come to the realization that a peace deal would be in their mutual interest and is the only way to move the country forward.
Now, regarding this other conflict in the western part of the country, some have said the U.S. was reluctant to bring up the situation in Darfur for fear of jeopardizing the peace talks. Is that accurate?
Well, actually, that is completely inaccurate. That perception has been out there, and I appreciate the opportunity to address it, because what we've done, of course, we have for the past 2 years been supporting an intensified peace process to achieve this agreement between the North and the South. But when Darfur became an issue, the humanitarian crisis there, we, the United States, exerted quite strong leadership. And in fact, our position has been that we are maintaining and intensifying pressure on Darfur, regardless of the state of play in the Naivasha peace talks. First of all, because that is the right thing to do. People are dying in Darfur, and horrendous atrocities have been committed. And secondly, because the government of Sudan understands pressure, and pressure is needed. They have not been cooperating, and we need to intensify the pressure until they do.
The government, in the U.S. government's opinion, is the government in Khartoum responsible for the carnage in Darfur?
Yes, they are responsible, in our view. Most of the atrocities in Darfur, which have been committed, and may I say are continuing to be committed even as we speak, are being carried out by the so-called Jinjaweet militia. These are Arab militia groups that have been supported by the government of Sudan. Their actions are often coordinated with, in fact, government of Sudan military forces. And they have been used in a quite systematic way to clear African tribal groups off the land in Darfur. So we do hold the government of Sudan fully responsible. Now, having said that, there are two armed opposition groups in Darfur which have been waging a fight against the government for local grievances. But they have not been the forces that have been carrying out, by and large, the atrocities.
If you're concerned, and obviously you are, for this effort to reach this North-South peace agreement, how can you trust the government to keep a peace agreement when it's conducting what some would describe as ethnic cleansing in another part of the country?
Yeah, I don't think we would trust either side, frankly, necessarily to carry out the agreement. That is why in the agreement, in the North-South Peace Agreement, there are sort of two key provisions being built in. One is a commitment to a Bill of Human Rights for the people of Sudan with quite specific provisions that the parties are held accountable to, and then a provision for intrusive international monitoring led by the United Nations to actually ensure that the North-South Peace Agreement is implemented. And we, as the United States, again, have taken leadership to mobilize the international community to carry out that monitoring once the agreement has been achieved. We believe that while we believe that the parties have an interest in carrying out the agreement, certainly it will need to be monitored and, if necessary, enforced by the international community.
And when you talk about pressure on Khartoum, on both sets of issues, North-South and, of course, Darfur,
right. What
kind of pressure are you talking about?
Well, we have done a variety of things. We have had a tremendous amount of U.S. Direct intervention with Khartoum in terms of phone calls from President Bush and other senior officials. We have made clear that we will not continue to defer the provisions of the Sudan Peace Act if Khartoum does not cooperate to achieve a deal. We did, in fact, waive the sanctions provisions in the Sudan Peace Act one more time in April to give the government a last chance to reach a North-South peace agreement. We have also, and this is a major point of leverage, we've indicated to Khartoum that we will not normalize relations with it unless it reaches a North-South peace accord, but at the same time takes the necessary steps in Darfur. So that normalization is tied to these, and normalization, of course, is something that Khartoum very much wants. We have also mobilized activity in the United Nations Security Council to address the Darfur issue.
And given that, with the lessons of Rwanda just 10 years ago, is it time now for the international community to intervene in Darfur?
Well, I think the international community is already involved on the Darfur issue, but I think it's important to note that while it's very important to keep in mind the Rwanda experience, we are not yet at that point in Sudan. Of course, we want to prevent it from being anything like that. What we have said is that ethnic cleansing has taken place in Darfur. This is this systematic movement of African villages and tribes from land in Darfur. But there has not been, say, a systematic effort to actually exterminate those people. Now, a number of people have been killed, and as I say, quite unspeakable atrocities have been committed, and we have condemned those in the strongest possible terms. And I would certainly agree with you that the international community has to take very forthright action in the face of that, but also, obviously, to prevent this thing sliding into genocide. But what has been happening is that the international community has been quite active. And again, the United States, as the country who's really been leading this peace process in Sudan, has been very, very active. We have mobilized briefings in the United Nations Security Council. We have made it clear that we're going to keep this issue on the agenda of the Security Council and that we are going to request more direct Security Council action in terms of things like sanctions should the government not take the necessary steps in Darfur. We've also been very active in pushing for international monitoring of a ceasefire in Darfur. And again, the United States helped to broker that ceasefire in Darfur about 4 weeks ago now. Since then, we've been working with the African Union to get international monitors actually on the ground.
Ambassador Ranneberger, thank you very much for your time. We know you just returned. You're busy. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Good talking to you.
Michael Ranneberger is Special Advisor for Sudan Policy at the Department of State. He spoke with us from his office here in Washington, D.C. Well, as you just heard, the situation in the Sudan is both confusing and alarming. At the same time that exhaustion and American pressure lend hope to the North-South peace talks, pro-government militias and Sudanese aircraft have killed tens of thousands in Darfur province and forced many more to flee across the border. This is not a religious conflict. Both sides are Muslims, but the militiamen are Arabs. Their victims are black. Some observers say the government is determined to drive the blacks out of the country in a massive campaign of ethnic cleansing. Others, despite what Ambassador Ranneberger just said, others describe it as genocide. How do we know what to do and when to do it when genocide raises its head? When does a civil war become something more? And 10 years after the shame of failure to intervene in Rwanda, What, if anything, has changed? Our number here in Washington, if you'd like to discuss these issues, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now by phone is Tone Kuhn. He's the emergency coordinator for Doctors Without Borders in Amsterdam. He coordinates the group's programs in the Darfur region and in neighboring Chad, and recently returned from the area. He joins us from his home in Amsterdam. Thanks very much for staying up to talk with us.
Good evening.
Is violence in Darfur still continuing?
Yes, indeed. It is. The conflict is still ongoing. Villages still being attacked. And in general, we can say that we have a major humanitarian crisis on hand in Darfur. The conflict has been definitely underreported and is still underrecognized in the international community. As the ambassador explained, yes, there has been a lot of effort from the international community, NGOs, United Nations, on the political level. However, it is still not enough, and the humanitarian support to the people in Darfur is still inadequate.
What's the scale of the situation?
Well, we have a million people displaced, and we haven't done a census, so it can also be 800,000 or 900,000. That doesn't really matter. It's a large-scale displacement of people. Additionally, there will be another million people directly affected by the conflict, and we have set up supplementary feeding activities, therapeutic feeding activities. We are vaccinating the people against measles. We have set up mobile clinics, distribution of food. The survey, the nutritional surveys we conducted in the last few weeks in different areas in Darfur, indicates deterioration of the food security and the general health situation of the people. We have already more than 4,000 children in our feeding center, of which 800 severely malnourished, which means if they don't get food, immediately they will die in the next couple of days. The general nutritional status is bad. Mm-hmm. We can see that the level of malnutrition is approximately 21.5%, which is considered to be twice the threshold for an emergency. There is a lack of actors who humanitarian agencies.
What about that? Is the government allowing aid organizations to assist the people?
Well, that's one of our major concerns. They do allow certain agencies work, and I wouldn't say that they refuse other agencies to get involved in the area. However, we face major humanitarian bureaucratic obstructions in having more expatriates present, which are necessary to run our projects and to get logistics in. For instance, we have, as an MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, in the area in Darfur, we have approximately 50 people on standby. We're waiting for visa. It takes approximately two months from the moment you identify a doctor or a nurse until the person is treating people in the clinic. So it's very difficult to plan these kind of activities.
We just have a minute or so left with you. From your recent visit, is there something you can tell us that you saw that would illustrate the problem?
Yeah. Well, I maybe a good way to illustrate is that. To tell you that I have been working for 15 years now with this Médecins Sans Frontières group, and I have been in several conflict areas. In many areas where I also have been in the last few months, like Uganda, where there's a humanitarian problem, a lot of people affected by conflict, there is at least some kind of relief when people reach feeding centers or our clinics. There is some kind of laughing, and they make the best out of it. In Darfur, there is absolutely no laughing in this feeding center. There's a complete depression and trauma among the population. They fear. There's a high level of fear. There is zero protection for these people while the atrocities are still continuing. So it's a very, very serious situation, and we have no indication that will improve in the next coming weeks.
Tone Kuhn, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Tone Kuhn of the Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières in Amsterdam. We'll have more on the crisis in Darfur and genocide when we come back from a break. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the humanitarian crisis in the Darfur region of Sudan and what it means for the effort to end genocide around the world. Of course, you're invited to join us. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Samantha Power, a lecturer in public policy at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government, the author of A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. She joins us from our bureau in New York, and thanks very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Some describe the situation in Darfur as a case of genocide. What responsibilities go along with the use of that term? Are governments or the UN forced to act?
Well, the Genocide Convention, which was drafted and signed in 1948, commits its signatories to take steps to prevent and punish. Needless to say, no country was going to ratify a treaty that obliged it to send its military forces to some unknown, unnamed future place. So all the states would really commit to would be to take steps, and of course that box can be checked simply by denouncing it or issuing a statement. So it's not a terribly exacting commitment. However, one of the things that's happened, of course, over the years is because of the association of the word genocide, first with the Holocaust and now with Rwanda, is that there is seen to be a political cost to using the term to describe atrocities underway and not doing something about it.
You cite a memo going back to Rwanda, a Pentagon memo that says, gee, if we describe it as genocide, we might actually have to do something.
Yeah, this is became known as the kind of genocide jig or the G word debate. There was a great trauma in the Clinton administration in the early to mid even to late 90s about whether to use the word genocide to apply to violence in Bosnia, to the concentration camps and so on, or even to the extermination campaign in Rwanda. And the political conclusion that was reached was if we use the word genocide, we will mobilize a latent constituency that exists out there in America to care about genocide, whereas if we call it civil war or ancient hatreds, then we won't, our hand won't be forced by domestic political concerns and constraints. We can just make judgments on the basis of national interest, and of course, for most of the 90s, mere atrocity didn't or wasn't seen to implicate national interest, so Bosnia went untended, for 3.5 years, and Rwanda went altogether untended while 800,000 people were killed.
Our number, if you'd like to join us again, is 800-989-8255. And let's take a call from Jessica, who's with us from Ortonville, Minnesota.
Hi. My question kind of relates to what you were just speaking about. I'm wondering why we have to call it genocide before we will do something, which you kind of already answered. And also, how many people have to die before we'll care? And I'm not speaking just to the politicians, but also to the press.
I think it's an excellent question, and actually, I think by virtue of looking at American responses to genocide over the last century, I have moved into the camp of people who thinks that the semantic debate and the obsession with getting the label affixed is actually just generates more white noise. If you look at Rwanda and Bosnia, especially Rwanda, almost more energy was spent deciding how to use the term, when to use the term, or from the standpoint of the press or the advocates outside to get the U.S. government to use the term, then was actually devoted to trying to save lives. It can become such a red herring. And I think also because there is no consensus over when the sort of genocide threshold has been crossed, my feeling is once you're having this debate, as we're already having now in the Darfur context, you're already in the red zone. You're already long past the time, to be having debates over semantics. This is already time to be thinking about how do we simply save the people who can still be saved in Darfur. And to your question factually about where that line exists, the language of the convention defines genocide not according to a body count, so it's not like if you kill 100,001 people, then you're in genocide. If you kill less than that, then it's only ethnic cleansing. They didn't want to do that because they didn't want statesmen to wait around or killers to kind of come just short of what that threshold was, in the hopes of staving off intervention. So the crime is actually defined in terms of intent, and it's an intent to destroy an ethnic, national, or religious group as such. That's been interpreted to include mass killing because, of course, it's really hard to destroy a group unless you kill enough members of that group where the rest of it feels it has to flee or kind of disappear as a group in order to preserve, individual members of the group. So Darfur is kind of meeting the threshold when it comes to ethnic cleansing and actually wiping out the group from a land, you know, so African farmers may never exist on this land again if they are not quickly repatriated and have their lives rebuilt and unless they get international protection. But you're not seeing a whole-scale extermination campaign like you saw in Rwanda in the Holocaust. And one of the problems with the way we've come to remember Rwanda is that to some extent it, like the Holocaust before it, has now put the bar in a place where there can be a kind of collective sigh of relief that it doesn't measure up to Rwanda or measure down, depending on how you look at it. And so, well, it's only 30,000 killed so far in Darfur, and it's a million people on the run, but, well, they're on the run and they're still alive, right? And somehow that's consoling, and it doesn't actually trigger the commitments that we've made in the wake of discovering just the kind of scale of the Rwandan tragedy of 1994.
Jessica, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
David Sheffer remembers Rwanda. He was the ambassador at large for war crimes issues during the Clinton administration. He also worked as senior counsel to the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations during the Rwandan crisis in 1994. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Thank you, Neil.
You were involved in the policy decisions during the conflicts in Rwanda and in Bosnia. Was this issue of genocide a real issue in definitions of the term in deciding how and when or whether to intervene?
Yes, Samantha had it just right in terms of how we reacted in 1994. The issue of how to define what was going on was somewhat of an all-consuming issue within the State Department and deeply involved the Office of the Legal Counsel, Legal Advisor's Office, in terms of going through a process of many days, in fact, many weeks, of working the issue to determine whether or not, in fact, genocide had occurred. And it was not until May 21st of 1994, about 6-7 weeks after the genocide began, that a very critical decision memo reached Secretary Christopher's desk for him to sign off on simply determining that acts of genocide had occurred and that we could use the word genocide in a meeting in Geneva a few days later. So all of that sort of reflected a very tardy and, frankly, very unfortunate exercise of concentration that should have been focused, as Samantha said, on simply responding to clear atrocities, clear crimes against humanity. Get beyond the semantics. It should be a 10-second exercise, because the important reaction of the government is how do we respond to these mass killings, pillage, rapes, and we can leave for another day, frankly, precisely how it's described. You know, it takes the prosecutor of the Yugoslav and Rwanda tribunal many months and sometimes many years in a particular case to determine whether or not there was a criminal intent on the part of a particular official to commit genocide. But in the meantime, governments have to act to the reality on the ground.
And in this case, as from what you know of Darfur, would you say it rises to that level?
Oh, I would be very clear to say that there. This is a phrase that we used during the Kosovo crisis of 1999. It's clear that there are indicators of genocide occurring now in Darfur. It's also clear that crimes against humanity and war crimes do appear to be taking place. I call these atrocity crimes. I think we simply need to use a term that we can easily grasp and understand, requires reaction to in real time. Lawyers and judges and prosecutors and defense counsel can ultimately determine precisely what kind of crime it is and how it should be prosecuted and carried through in terms of sentencing. But there's no question that in Darfur, very, very serious atrocity crimes of significant magnitude are occurring.
Samantha Power, let me bring you in again and ask you. Yesterday, Secretary of State Powell said the United States needs to do more on the Darfur issue. You heard earlier Ambassador Ranneberger, who's just back from the North-South peace talks, say the structure of that agreement is hinged to what goes on in Darfur. Is that enough? What needs to happen now?
Well, I think, first of all, that the Bush administration should be commended for at least provisionally being able to walk and chew gum at the same time. That is, There was a lot of fear a couple months ago that because the North-South peace process was so precious and because the Bush administration had invested so much political capital in it and it would be a great feather in the cap of an administration more known for war than for peace, but that this would cause its officials who had worked the Sudan issue to blind themselves to the scale of the horror in Darfur. I don't think that's what's happened. I actually think that they've been managing both processes as best they can, trying on the one hand to denounce Khartoum for what's happening in Darfur and trying to get them to disarm the Janjaweed and to stop participating in the atrocities, and trying to keep this peace process going. It's very difficult to do both, however, and certainly the extent of the perhaps the pitch of the denunciation is necessarily going to be tempered by the dependence on Khartoum, in this other area. I think the Bush administration stands alone, as it happens so far, on the Earth, on the planet Earth, in its willingness to take Darfur seriously. What it's not, however, doing is moving out of the realm of bilateral diplomatic consultation, occasional denunciation, into the, oh my God, a million people are on the run, the rainy seasons are starting, they're going to be inaccessible, that level of urgency. David Sheffer, who I interviewed at length for my book, I think had a great way of putting it in the Rwanda context, which was that we mustered a conventional response to an unconventional crisis. And this is what the Bush administration's response thus far feels like, a very, very conventional ritual diplomatic response where they go to the UN Security Council, go to the UN Human Rights Commission, make the phone calls behind the scenes once every couple weeks. It has to be said, again in their defense, however, that they are not being joined by anybody. The Europeans have not shown up at all. The Secretary General at the UN made one very important statement about a month ago, around the time of the Rwandan anniversary, of the 10-year anniversary of the genocide, but since then has not made any public statement, again, geared at taking what is ultimately so far just a U.S. diplomatic response and making internationalizing it, so of course it'll have greater legitimacy and greater credibility with Arab countries, of course, in the region, with the African Union, and so on. So the U.S. is doesn't have the legitimacy in international institutions to show up and get what it wants because it's been discredited, I think, in other areas, but also because other countries are quite frankly quite selfish and don't see what's in it for them to get involved in something that they can say, well, the Americans are handling it, so leave it up to them to see if they can get monitors in.
David Sheffer?
Well, I would simply second what Samantha has said and say that, this administration has created some obstacles now in the last few years that now make it quite difficult for them to surmount in terms of gaining that kind of international support. I do recognize the efforts that they have made, however, and I think those are to be commended. But if I may offer, Neil, just a couple of suggestions. This is exactly the moment when we should be back in the Security Council. I would suggest to press for two initiatives in one or more resolutions. One would be a Chapter 7, we call that an enforcement resolution, with the full power of the Security Council behind it, to create some kind of humanitarian corridor within Darfur that permits humanitarian aid agencies to enter with safety and security, and also the deployment of some UN forces on Darfur territory to permit this. That may be necessary if the Khartoum government were to resist it. But it is possible within the power of the Security Council to create that kind of humanitarian corridor within Darfur. And then secondly, the issue of accountability is going to be there, and it is there in terms of the commission of these crimes. And the least that the Security Council could do at this moment is to set up a commission of experts that establishes the first international record of suspected crimes in the Darfur region, as preparation for ultimate justice in that part of the world. The justice deficit in Sudan and Uganda and elsewhere is so great that it does have an impact on the ability to sustain long-term peace agreements.
We're speaking with David Sheffer, former ambassador at large for war crimes issues during the Clinton administration, and with Samantha Power of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Jane, who joins us from Smithfield, Utah.
Yes, first of all, thank you for having a program on this subject. Regarding what Mr. Scheffler just said regarding the United Nations, I'm wondering, it seems so overwhelming to get the United Nations to do anything. Is it not the case that the UN Commission on Human Rights has refused to condemn the Sudanese regime in the first place? So is it possible that his suggestion could actually occur, and what would have to happen really to make it occur? Would it just be continued emphasis on the urgency genocide issue by the Bush administration? Mm-hmm. Does it help to have... It would be wonderful to see American Muslims on the phone calling this administration, among many other things.
We may have a couple of other issues first, but go ahead.
An excellent question from Utah. You are right that we have suffered a setback in the Commission on Human Rights recently, and we're going to have to deal with that setback in terms of reluctance to properly condemn Sudan and also permit the highest level type of UN envoy into Sudanese territory and Darfur to examine the issue. But the Security Council is not the commission. Mm-hmm. And I think it is within our capability to bring along the five permanent members as well as four other members. You need 9 votes to establish what I have suggested, and even at a minimum to overcome what the problems we had with the commission, to ensure that some UN human rights monitors could get on the ground in Darfur without all of these visa problems, which our good friend from Médecins Sans Frontières was speaking about a little while ago. So I do think that the diplomacy is possible within the Security Council, even if we have to work very hard for a Chinese abstention or a Russian abstention. And frankly, here in the States, if I may say so, nothing could be more of a bipartisan issue than this. I would like to see President Bush and John Kerry sit down together on this issue and make a pronouncement as to the seriousness of it.
And I wanted to go to Samantha Power. Again, diplomacy is important. It takes time. It goes on. In the meantime, people continue to die in Darfur. And I'm afraid we just have a few seconds left.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're treating this now as a humanitarian problem, not a political problem. So all the focus is on, you know, can we raise money, $170 million, so as to get the appropriate food, you know, in the warehouses so as to be sent, when in fact the very subtle form of destruction that is going on here is to purge people from their homes and ensure that they don't get access to that food. So it's not death by machete, but death or flight by virtue of starvation. And the United States has gone to the Security Council twice and has been thwarted not only, unfortunately, by the Russians and the Chinese, but remarkably by the British, who have taken the side of Sudan and of Algeria and Pakistan on the council. So what it will require, I think, is an awful lot of bilateral diplomacy and perks to be offered not merely to human rights skeptics, but actually to the countries that like to build themselves as human rights friends.
Jane, thanks very much for the call. And I'd like to thank David Scheffer, Ambassador-at-Large for War Crimes during the Clinton Administration, and Samantha Power, her book, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. When we come back from a short break, a Shakespearean tale rising out of 9/11. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.